A global thinker of the evening, Mersey Tate. She was an expert on US diplomacy and the first African-American woman to come to Oxford. Speaking on her tonight is Cecilia Lynch, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of California, Irvine. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Good.
Perfect.
Good. She specializes in international relations theory, religion, ethics, and social movements. And she's also won the International Studies Association's J. Ann Tickner Award.
Before we begin the talk on Mersey Tate, we're honored to have with us today our Vice Chancellor, Professor Louise Richardson, to provide us with opening remarks on 100 years of women being matriculating, being allowed to study officially at Oxford. She's a political scientist by training, a professor of international relations, and like our thinker tonight, she also earned her doctorate in government from Harvard University. So thank you very much for being with us today, Vice Chancellor. Over to you.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and something of an embarrassment to be learning about such an extraordinary woman who is a product of Oxford, and I think it just speaks to the fact that for so long women have been written out of history. It's precisely for that reason that this year we're celebrating the centenary of the matriculation of women by creating the Hillary Rodham Clinton Chair in Women's History to start to redress the fact that women for too long have been written out of our history. And when I think about some of these women, I think about somebody like Laura Bassi, who in 1731 was appointed professor of physics at the University of Bologna at the age of 21. She was the highest earner in the faculty, did extraordinary early work on electricity, had 10 children in the course of her extraordinary career, and I bet none of you have ever heard of her. And she wasn't alone. There was a contemporary of hers called Maria Ignazzi, who was a mathematician, the eldest of 21 children, who wrote a treatise on the importance of women's education in Latin at the age of 9, had an extraordinary academic career, and died in poverty. And again, I'm sure none of you have heard of her. Some of you will have heard, because we're at Oxford, of one of the early women of whom we're proud, Cornelia Cerracci. I thought I'd mention her because of the link with Somerville. She was the first woman to attend Bombay University, and she finished with the highest marks in the university. But because she was female, she was not given the award which was given to the student with the highest marks at the university to come to Oxford. But she managed, together with some supporters in Oxford, to cobble together the funding to allow her to come. She came to Somerville, and she was the first woman to study for the BCL. Congregation had to pass a special resolution to allow her to take the exams. She was the first female to study in the Coddington Library, and became the first woman to practice at the bar at both in India and in the UK. But of course, she couldn't collect her degree from Oxford until decades after she'd actually earned it. So, as many of you know, in 1879, Somerville and LMH opened as the two women's colleges at Oxford. So there was this discreet, nice little annex where girls could go and could study, and were kind of watching from the sidelines as men were in the real colleges. They could actually study, their view, not mine, of course. They could study the same subjects, but could even take the same exams, although marking was separate, because it turned out they did rather well in the exams. So but they were not, of course, allowed to collect their degrees. But one of my favourite stories of this period was the years 1904 to 1907, because in 1904, Trinity College Dublin decided to admit women. And as some of you may know, there are only two other universities whose degrees Oxford recognises, Trinity and Cambridge. So, for example, when I was appointed Vice-Chancellor, even though I didn't have an Oxford degree, I was all right, because my Trinity BA counted where my Oxford PhD went. But in any event, because of this law of mutual recognition, some of the extraordinary women who had studied in both Oxford and Cambridge, who had qualified for a degree but not been allowed to collect it, realised that they could get it in Trinity. So there was a 3-year period when Trinity was permitted to graduate women, but didn't have any of its own because they hadn't graduated. So there's an enterprising provost there called Thomas Traill, and he invited women from Oxford and Cambridge to come over to Trinity to get their degrees. So in this 3-year period, 703 women took the steamboat from the UK over to Dublin. They were known as the Steamboat Ladies. They went over, they had a celebration, paid a fee, and got their degrees, sometimes reflecting work that they had done decades earlier. Provost Traill then used the money to build Trinity Hall, which was the Hall of Residence for girls in Trinity, which is where I lived as an undergraduate. In any event, this ended in 1907 because Trinity was able to graduate its own students. So women then had to wait until 1920 to matriculate here at Oxford. So it's quite extraordinary. It took, we're so old, we don't quite know how old, but roughly 800 years before women were admitted. And I don't know about you, but I often wonder, you know, what books would have been written, what poetry composed, what musical scores, what research, what diseases cured, if women had access to the same education as men for those many hundreds of years. So we've come a long way since the 300 years since Lara Bassi and 100 years since the Steamboat Ladies, but we still have a ways to go. Only 25% of professors in European universities are female. Only 17% of the top 200 universities are led by women. So we still have a ways to go, but progress is being made. Last year, for the first time, we admitted more undergraduate females at Oxford than males. So it really depends on your perspective. I think the trajectory is clear. The pace is too slow, but we're getting there. And we're getting there in part because of the extraordinary women we don't know about who were here, who were studied. Those steamboat ladies went on to become heads of many of the great girls' schools in this country. So we are standing on the shoulders of giants, and I look forward to hearing more about one of them this evening. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And as also an Irish American who's here, it's a particular pleasure to have you here as both as Vice Chancellor, but also to give the introduction. It's really wonderful. Thank you. And I want to thank Marina and Sharoni, and also Richard and St. Cross College and Somerville College and Oxford University and all of you for making this possible. This is wonderful for me. This is very much a side project for me, so I also have to thank Bob Vitalis, who I believe you also corresponded with, who wrote this book that kind of shook the Academy a few years ago, White World Order, Black Power Politics. And I met Bob, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about how you come to me and not the real expert on Mersey Tate, who is Professor Barbara Savage at University of Pennsylvania, who is writing an intellectual biography of Mersey Tate. All right, back in the 1980s, Bob and I each had, I'm sorry, 1990s, we had, we each were postdoc SSRC MacArthur Fellows. We were hanging out at a fancy hotel in San Salvador and talking about our projects. And Bob's project was actually what ended up as this book. And it was quite controversial, looking at the racialized and racist history of the field. And apparently the hoo-ha SSRC MacArthur committee decided only to give him 1 year of this wonderful two-year, I had a two-year project. And they only decided to give him 1 year because I think they were quite, there was a big controversy on that committee about it. He had a couple of very strong supporters and some who were not as strong. So there's a thread of what scholarship can get published and what can't, I think, throughout our relationship. Fast forward to last fall, I asked Bob and several other scholars to be on a panel at the APSA that was a 20-year retrospective of my first book called Beyond Appeasement with Cornell. And when I did an article that came out in the retrospective International Theory
journal called The Moral Aporia of Race in IR, and that came out last spring. I was asked to do morality in IR, so I did that, and there were a number of back and forths on this, which is also an interesting story. But I have also been working increasingly on humanitarianism and working with colleagues in Africa. So this question of race and racialization of the field and humanitarianism, and et cetera, has been something of increasing concern to me. So I asked several scholars of race and international relations, including Bob Siba-Grovegi, my colleague Tiffany Willoughby-Herard, who did a fantastic book on the Carnegie Corporation in South Africa and their acceptance of eugenics and racialized hierarchies in the early 20th century, and Jeannie Moorfield, who did a book on Alfred Zimmern and Gilbert Murray. And I asked them, tell me what I did wrong, what I left out in this book, because doing a bunch of archival research for this book, I realized I'd come across some troubling issues around race and the Ruhr Valley, for example, in 1923. Also, just the whole racialization. I read Austin Chamberlain's papers, among others. Boy, he was one for categorizing everyone. Anyway, Bob's comments were, Cecilia, I should have read your book more carefully before, but now that I have, I want to, instead of telling you what to write, how you should have rewritten it, I'm going to give you this book by Mersey Tate. And it's out of print, and you should be the one to write an article on her. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. And I knew just a little bit about her. The APSA had renamed, and I'll come to that later, an award in her honor a few years ago. I knew that she was a major scholar of what he and some others have called the Howard School of International Relations. I didn't know an awful lot about her work, but fast forward, I get an invitation to come and talk to you. So I've been in the midst of working on all kinds of other things. But I was very intrigued about Bob's idea, and I thought, okay, as long as you know that I am not the expert on her, and as long as you know that, you know, what you're getting is my working through this, then fine, I'll do this. But that's how I came to her. And also, one of the fascinating things for me is that she and I worked on some of the same issues. So for her dissertation at Harvard, which came out of her B.Lit. Here, and she worked under Alfred Zimmern. She worked on proposals for disarmament throughout the 19th century up to 1907. Her second book, which is this one, The United States and Armaments, takes that through. This was published in 1948, and it takes that through series of naval conferences, which I wrote about, and also the World Disarmament Conference, which I wrote about as well. So we worked on some of the same things, although differently, and I'm going to talk about that. And so for that reason, I thought, you know, I too was very embarrassed at not knowing of her or her work, although I think the reasons I didn't know of her are not entirely my fault, and I'm not trying to absolve myself, but I think that there is this question that many women in the field have come back to about citation politics, and many black scholars and scholars of color are also coming to about citation politics, and people like Bob and others have talked about as well. So you asked me first to review her bio a bit and then to approach her work, so I'm going to do that now. In preparing for this talk, I found this is a children's book on Mersey Tate, and it has a lot of photographs of her. So I'm just going to play a little show and tell and pass it around, because it's a lovely little book, and it was published in Kalamazoo, Michigan, which is where the place where she got her undergraduate degree is. It's Western Michigan University, which I happen to have seen many times because my son went to Kalamazoo College, which is across the street from Western Michigan University. And so she was a brilliant scholar, clearly, by all measures. She had an amazing intellect and passion for her work. She did have this formative link to Oxford. And so in addition to pictures from the book, of course, I'm drawing on the work of Barbara Savage and Bob Vitalis, as well as her own work. But her family background was quite fascinating. Her grandfather was an inventor, and actually she invented a method of freezing ice cream and patented it. Her parents were what was called homesteaders. Apparently they profited from an early post-Civil War law in the U.S. that gave land. It wasn't simply, though, to Black Americans. This was also to white Americans. And her parents got land in Michigan. And they were one of the few Black families in a largely white area. So her school, her initial school, only went through 10th grade. And that's, in U.S. terms, only half of her high school education. So she then went to another high school, and then she was accepted to Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And she Western Michigan was really good to her, and she was always graduating at the top of her class and everything. But later on, she would come to really remember Western Michigan in important ways. After she graduated, she wanted to teach high school, but was not allowed to in Michigan as a Black woman, as an African American, in Michigan, which is in the North. And so what she did was she was able to teach high school in Indiana. And so she taught at a high school in Indianapolis. Then she decided she wanted to go on for a master's degree at Columbia in history and then on to Oxford. So here at Oxford, she worked with Alfred Zimmern, among others, the international law expert, Brearley, and also several other scholars here, of course. I don't know about where if the Zimmern papers are here or if they're in London. It would be wonderful to know if he talks about her at all in his own papers. That I do not know. So along the way, I'm also going to give you some issues that I don't know, as not Barbara Savage, who was here, I think, all of last year working on the biography, the intellectual biography. So I will pose some of those questions. I should have said at the beginning that if anybody wants to interrupt or add an anecdote or something, please feel free to do so. I don't consider this a very formal presentation. Her PhD, according to Bob Vitalis, she was in the same area as folks like W.E.B. Du Bois, working on comparative colonial administrations, which I think was a big deal at the time. But that was not her dissertation work at all. She then had a position at a women's college in the South, and eventually she was hired at Howard University. Now, Ralph Bunche, who also has awards named after him and was a Nobel laureate, and Eric Williams, who then became one of the first post-independence prime ministers of Trinidad and Tobago, I believe, didn't want to hire her. They didn't want to hire women at Howard in the poli-sci department. So history hired her as a diplomatic historian. And she also became a world traveler. She was an excellent photographer. Some of the photographs in there were taken by her. She used her press credentials. She also wrote for the press to interview Nehru, for example, around the time of the Bandung conference. And she was an active philanthropist, and I wonder how she managed to give $1 million to Western Michigan as an academic, but somehow I think she was a shrewd investor as well. So she was quite the Renaissance woman. She gave and endowed scholarships at both Western Michigan and Howard, and she lived to the age of 91. So she was clearly a first in so many ways. She liked to say she was the first African-American grad student, or at the time Negro graduate student, at Oxford. And apparently there was an African-American man who had been an undergraduate, and she said, yes, but I was the first postgraduate student, I believe one says here. And, you know, she came from a pioneering family. She apparently, according to Barbara Savage and Vavatalis, did not want to see herself simply as a Black scholar or African American scholar. And I think that comes across in a lot of her work. She was clearly a strong self-advocate at Howard, according to Barbara Savage. She was going to the dean's office quite frequently saying, "You're not paying me as much as you're paying the men." And she became known a bit as a troublemaker sometimes. And she did get higher salaries. She would also make it very clear that she was not Deadwood publishing, that she was out there publishing more than a lot of the men. So she was very much a self-advocate and an advocate for other women as well on teaching loads. And apparently she was quite a wonderful mentor as well. So she did experience sexism as well as racism, in other words. Although, you know, she clearly had a strong sense of, and I've not read her papers, but it just seems to come across quite strongly that she had a sense of confidence and self-worth that was quite strong and unusual for many people. So when she arrived at Oxford, this is, to the left is a matriculation of a document from Oxford, and it wants to know the father's profession. And so she put retired farmer, which I thought was interesting. To the right is a poem she wrote that Barbara Savage, so far Barbara Savage has published one chapter in this book, Toward an Intellectual History of Black Women, on Mersey Tate. She has another piece coming out on Mersey Tate and disarmament, so I have to wait for that before I write the piece that Bob Vitalis suggested I write, and then she's got an intellectual biography coming out as well. But this poem is also reprinted in that little book there. And so, you know, she brings in God, she brings in her, she said she wants to be a prayer, to be a credit to my race and my sorority. So it wasn't that she was not conscious of being Black in a white academy at all, in fact. She was quite conscious of that. So she saw this as a very important achievement, and so did the Black women's sorority that she had been part of. And they had given her a scholarship to study for a postgraduate degree, but they doubled it from $1,000 to $2,000 when they found out she was coming to Oxford, because they knew that she would need that money. So I don't know what kind of debates her admission might have been part of. That would be something very interesting to study, and I don't know if Barbara Savage has been able to look at that. Her eventual... Oh, this is her... the report of the examiners. So J.L. Brearley and C.A.W. Manning, Manning of the LSC, and it basically... Let's see, I don't know which... Marina found this, which is wonderful in the art here. But it discusses what the thesis is concerned with. It basically says that it's she's used a number of original sources, that it's a very competent thesis, and it's all done in that sort of wonderful British understatement way, but you can tell that it's complimentary at the same time. So, yes, I remember when I first started asking for letters of recommendation, there was the question of whether one should ask in the U.S. Academy for a letter from a British scholar, because everything would be downplayed. And in the U.S., of course, everything is the best of this or the best. Anyway. Her eventual critique of colonialism and imperialism did not emerge, in my reading anyway, at Oxford, nor at Harvard. She was used to rising to the top of any class. Hang on a second, this is what I want. She was used to rising to the top of any class. And I think that, you know, she was quite well thought of by her committee. Her work in her first two books on armaments and arms control, centered on disarmament, weaponry, arms control, and also sovereignty. And later, her later scholarly work in the 1950s and 60s moved into the South Pacific and the issue of Hawaii. So Hawaii got its statehood in the U.S. in 1959. Mirzi Tate started doing a lot of research on Hawaii, I believe, in the late 50s. And I am not an expert on that, although I do have one of her books from our library on Hawaii, and I have looked through that book, which I will comment on in a minute. But I'm going to focus primarily on her work that intersected more with my own work in my first book. And so the question of interest to her was why and how disarmament was so difficult. And of course, that was a question of the time throughout the early 20th century, even now. And as others did, she analyzed the problem as a political problem, right, rather than a technical problem. That division between the political and the technical in terms of arms control and disarmament mechanisms was always something that was, you know, E.H. Carr brought it out, others brought it out as well. So her dissertation and her first book on the illusion, the disarmament illusion, she talked about disarmament proposals from 1815 on, so the post-Napoleonic era, etc. And in my own work, I also dated a lot of those from that time because that was the historiography that I also found. Now, she did a lot of archival work on the 19th century, which I did not do in my first book. But she also talked about the peace societies in the U.S. and the U.K., as in other countries. And in many ways, these are works of diplomatic history, but I think they have a couple of interesting twists. Now, this first is not the twist, but a lot of what she moved from the early post-Napoleonic era and the rise of nonconformist peace movements to the Rush-Bajo Agreement of the 1950s, which demilitarized the Great Lakes region between the U.S. and Canada, and eventually this became the entire demilitarization of the U.S.-Canadian border. And I found this interesting. One thing I do not know, is when I think about her parents as homesteaders, in Michigan, what I have read so far says nothing about her views or anybody's views on Native Americans. So that land was somebody's land. And she does make a reference to the U.S. as being empty at one point. So she's kind of repeating that terra nullius mythology about the U.S. At one point here. It changes later, so I'm gonna talk a little bit about that. But the fact that her family was probably, you know, even though this was not a direct transfer from Native Americans to, you know, it had already happened. It couldn't have been that much longer, that much prior. And then when she talks about Rush Bago, she does not, again, talk about the reasons for the militarization of the border and of the Great Lakes. Now, I'm sure that a lot of it had to do with Canadian, British, and U.S. differences after 1814, but one would imagine that, you know, there were other reasons as well for militarization across the U.S. And I would like to see more work done on that, and I'm not sure if that's coming out in Barbara Savage's book, but that's something that occurred to me. She then moves to mid-19th century liberals, and the work of liberals, I also deal somewhat with free traders in the mid-19th centuries, and then she moves to pacifist and women's and workers' groups, and late 19th century international peace congresses. Then she moves to the Tsar's proposals of 1898, which resulted then in the First Hague Conference. And she goes to the First Hague and the Second Hague Conference. And she begins this book, her second book, with again an overview of Rush Bago and then of the Tsar's peace proposals. So I had not seen before, and Professor Roberts can probably tell us more about this, but I had not seen such treatment of the Tsar's proposals before, and I don't know if some of this might have been Zimmern's, who of course was a League of Nations, you know, aficionado, theorist, as well as activist. I don't know if that might have been part of it, but certainly I remember the peace groups glomming onto the Tsar's proposal. See, if he can propose these things, we can certainly do it. Of course, that doesn't happen, but I thought her analysis, her spending time on those analyses was very interesting. In the second book, after dealing with those things again, she then moves into the series of four naval conferences between, they were either five power or three power, but the primary powers were the US, the UK, and Japan. And the first one was the Washington Naval Conference, 1920-21, then she goes to the what I called the Coolidge Naval Conference of 26, which was the Geneva Naval Conference, the London Naval Conference of 30, and I didn't bother with the London Naval Conference of 35, but she does. And then she also talks about the World Disarmament Conference of 1932-34. And she begins and ends this book with a discussion of the Atlantic Charter and the post-World War II world and the creation of the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Association, and the impact of the atom bomb. So she opens and closes with the impact of the atomic era on arms control and arms races from the U.S. So it's clear, some of the things that struck me, having pored over documents at the PRO, the National Archives, the League of Nations Archives, the London School of Economics, the British Library for my own dissertation work and first book, some things that struck me, given that I had no idea what I was getting into, since my advisors at Columbia did not do this kind of archival work and said, oh, just go do it. I learned a lot. I read debates about 6-inch versus 8-inch guns on cruisers, and she deals with those between the U.S. and Britain in a lot of detail. She knew her technical issues. She knew what was going on with the atomic bomb, clearly, you know, and the various issues involved. She'd read not only the Baruch plan, but the Acheson-Lilienfeld plan on which it was based. She analyzed them all quite thoroughly. Also, another thing that she did in this book less, because it wasn't the topic of her book in the second book, on U.S. Disarmament, the United States and armaments. But she dealt with peace groups and peace movements different than many of the diplomatic historians of her time, certainly Carr or Butterfield or Lippmann. I don't know if you want to call him a diplomatic historian, or later people like Alexander George and Gordon Craig. In that, While she discussed the rise of public opinion and the rise of popular movements as a newish feature of the 19th and early 20th century, she also accepted it as not something that was supposed to go away, as something that was naive or stupid. She gave them their due. And I found that very interesting. In my book, I talk a lot about how they were dismissed, or there were attempts to dismiss them. Also, in every single one of her books, there's an extremely vast use of archival sources, memoirs, and secondary sources, and I know this must have been quite difficult. She clearly had access to some things I did not know about or have access to. I had access to others, I'm sure, in terms of, for example, the Public Record Office has a 30-year rule and a 50-year rule for, and of course she wouldn't have had access to those things. A few aspects in terms of the concepts she dealt a lot with in her work that I want to highlight include a lot of discussion of the status quo powers versus non-status quo powers, which made me think immediately of Morgenthau, among others. And apparently, and I did check, Politics Among Nations does cite her books. I think that she was not sufficiently cited otherwise, but I read in Bob Vitalis's work that Morgenthau liked her work. And he does cite her, both of these first two books that I've been talking about. She also did a lot of work on the technical versus the political aspects of disarmament, as I said before. And that's very much like others of her time, although she might have been noting some of these problems earlier than others. At the end of this book, she says, what was the big deal about naval parity anyway? First she takes the U.S. to task, then she takes Britain to task. And, you know, earlier on she's describing all the technical aspects and sort of putting them into place. This wasn't technical. These were political issues. Neither one of them really wanted to, you know, the U.S. wanted parity and eventual superiority. Britain did not want the U.S. to catch up, etc. And at the end she basically says, okay, all right, really? You know, was that such a big deal? So I think that that's quite interesting. She also worked on the relationship between arbitration and disarmament. And she has an interesting critique of both peace movement and government peace conference proposals. So she says that they often put arbitration first as the solution to war, but she insisted that arbitration would not work if a country's not wasn't satisfied with the status quo. So she goes back to the discussion of status quo powers versus non-status quo powers. She did not have a radical critique of U.S. policies or British policies, and apparently W.E.B. Du Bois, according to Bob Vitalis, he had a critique of her first book that says she did not address the significance of imperialism in the 19th century arms races and arms increases, as he was doing at the time as well. And I think that that's something that I specifically looked for. There's nothing about the scramble for Africa. There's nothing about imperialism in that sense. She describes the movements, the different movement lineages, if you will, to talk about who was agitating for what, but she doesn't really talk about the anti-imperialists, which I found quite interesting. She does include a few wry observations, especially on U.S. imperialism, and she basically just states that the U.S. had become an imperial power with the 1898 Spanish-American War. So, you know, that's just that, no matter what the U.S. wants to say. She did extremely careful empirical research, again, her work on the Baruch Plan, as well as all of the London, all of the naval conferences. Is quite interesting. Now, regarding the atom bomb and atomic materials, she included a lot of detail on U.S. memos, and she pointed out that the Baruch Plan was actually a step backward from the Acheson-Lilienthal plan in the 1940s, in that Baruch was pretty clear that the U.S. could continue to produce bombs until international control was achieved, or until adequate safeguards were achieved, although adequate safeguards were never really defined. So there was this big debate on what do we do now that the U.S. has used these bombs, what do we do with this incredible force? And the Soviet Union, Gromyko and Molotov, said, first we need a pledge not to use atomic weapons, and we also need to destroy existing bombs, and then maybe we can create an international agency. Whereas the U.S. said, let's create the international agency with adequate safeguards once we've done that, but we can still continue to build our bombs while that's happening. Once we've done that, then we can talk about the others. So Tate's argument was that we needed international control from raw materials all the way through both peaceful civil nuclear uses and bombs, military uses, and international authority. And she begins and ends this book with a discussion of kind of an international peace force and then international atomic agency, but she realizes that the real problem here is this question of sovereignty and question of status quo versus non-status quo. So that's how she frames the issues. Now, what's interesting is that while she has no discussion here of race or racialized international politics, unlike many of her colleagues at Howard University, where she was hired in 1942. Her first book came out then, and then this book came out in 48. But in 1943, she has a piece called The War Aims of World War I and World War II and Their Relation to the Darker Peoples of the World. And she publishes this in the Journal of Negro Education in 1943. And here she lets all loose. I mean, one thing that she does that I actually like, because I read some of E.H. Carr's papers when he was in the Labour Party government in the 20s, and I was never a big fan of the 20 Years' Crisis, unlike many of my British colleagues, even people who with whom I agree on many, many other things. And she doesn't like him either, so I like that. She says in this article, examples of well-meaning but completely inadequate approaches to the problem of a global peace are Edward Hallett Carr, Conditions of Peace, Herbert Hoover and Hugh Gibson, The Problems of Lasting Peace, Harold Butler, The Lost Peace, and J.P. Conliffe, Agenda for a Post-War World. Then she says, World War II, when considered realistically, is not fought for the four freedoms everywhere. This is still in the middle of World War II. It is a militarist and imperialist struggle for freedom and power, power for some at the expense of others. She talks about the Atlantic Charter and the four freedoms, and later she says, what we need is an Atlantic, not just an Atlantic Charter, but a Pacific Charter, an Africa Charter, and she talks about different regions of the world. And then she also talks about the theory of white superiority and the refusal of the British Empire delegation. This is in The War Aims, to accept a revised and innocuous clause endorsing principle of equality of nations and just treatment of their nationals. And this was back in the interwar period. So I find these things really quite interesting in terms that she was doing this at the same time. Now, this book was Harvard University Press. This is the Journal of Negro Education. We're going to have to wait for Barbara Savage's book to find out the intricacies of this. But I'm giving you all these things so that when you will read her book and know some of the things to look for. In 1950, she was a Fulbright scholar to India. And according to both Vitalis and Savage, this helped to shape her views on race and racialization even further. She was a world traveler, and in the 60s, she did her two books on Hawaii, and one became a bestseller, and it was also dedicated to her brothers, and she was interested in the desegregation of the U.S. Army under President Truman, so I don't know if her brothers might have served in the Pacific. That's what I was also wondering. In this, though, she again does her, and I've just been able to read this through quickly, parts of it quickly, but she talks about, she goes into great detail on political economy to talk about the questions of the sugar industry in Hawaii and the development of the sugar industry and this reciprocity treaty between the U.S. and the Kingdom of Hawaii in 1875. But she also talks about this from the perspective of Hawaiians. And she, toward the end, she concludes, after 6 years of satisfactory operation of the treaty, not one Hawaiian of pure blood in all the islands owned or operated exclusively a sugar or rice plantation. Also, the Hawaiian population declined and continued to decline after this treaty was in effect. The Hawaiian Patriotic League, which opposed the reciprocity agreement, argued, and she quotes this argument, that no American has ever brought into this country any capital worth mentioning, but many have sent away fortunes made here. And so she brings together some of these issues that have been brought on other areas of the world, but she documents very cleanly the political economy of sugar, et cetera, in Hawaii. She also argues that a lot of the capitalists in Hawaii were the sons of missionaries who had gone to Hawaii to convert, and so their children were educated in separate schools that were set up for that purpose. So they didn't mix with Hawaiians. And they then start to reject their parents', you know, religious vocations, and instead start buying property, right, because they're fairly well off. And so she traces that out, that role of the missionaries. And apparently later, according to Bob Vitalis, her unpublished manuscripts, which are in her archives, were on railways and mines and missionaries and imperialism, including in Africa. She then made some trips to Africa as well and started. She was a guest of the Rhodesian government because she wanted to study issues of mines. So she was making these connections before a lot of other folks, I think, were doing that. But you don't see them a lot in here. But I will come back to some interesting things on that. Wait a minute. We want to go here. So if we think about the Howard School and her place in it, the Howard School is a constructed category, as I understand it, and includes after Howard University had its first black president in the early 20th century, how he brought together this group of scholars who were somewhat, or groups of scholars who were quite excellent, somewhat disparate as well. And Zachary Williams, his book on the Talented Tenth, talks about this Howard School and predates Bob Vitalis' book. So one view of the Howard School, or the Howard School, is his, that these people were accomplished and they were recognized. And so Mersey Tate, for him, for Zachary Williams, was a consummate scholar and public intellectual. Her work was widely respected within the Howard community and beyond. She was the first African-American woman to earn a PhD in government and international relations from Harvard. She was at Howard for 35 years, and then she produced some of the finest scholarship in foreign policy studies. She was often called on as a foreign policy expert by both Congress and the UN. Her impact on students was as influential as the respect she commanded within the intellectual and policy community. And another view is that of Bob Vitalis, who says, not that she was not respected, but basically he's then looking at the legacy of not only Mersey Tate, but also others, and how, as we all know in this room, she disappeared from view, and how could that have happened? Of course, Du Bois did not, but Du Bois, Vitalis is trying to, is arguing, and I think quite persuasively, should also be considered a scholar of interest and great importance to international relations, although he, that only now is beginning to happen. So these are different views of her scholarship. I do want to say a note about the award that was created in her name in 2015. It's the Mersey Tate Best Dissertation in International Relations and International History Award. It used to be called the Helen Dwight Reed Award. And I remember this from a long time ago, and I didn't quite realize that the change. But it happened when David Lake was president. So I emailed David the other day, and he got back to me right away. And I said, you know, how did this come about? I heard you were the one who pushed this forward. And he said, well, we found out, or APSA found out, the Helen Dwight Reed, in 2010, there was a foundation that supported this award. The foundation went defunct in 2010. APSA didn't do anything about it for a few years. So he becomes APSA president, and he said, okay, he remembered something of Helen Dwight Reed. Her one book was about racialized categories and how people of different races, it was very much buying into eugenics, and he came across it in his work on hierarchy and international order. He thought, there's no reason to resurrect that name, the foundation is defunct, etc. So he created but he remembered also coming across something of Mersey Tate's. And so he created a committee that was headed by Ashley Reed, who has since been one of the women, along with Barbara Walter and others in the US, to write a lot about citation politics and how they exclude women in our field. And they recommended Mersey Tate. And so APSA on its website then says that why she was given this award. And it talks about her work. It says that most of her career was spent as a professor of history at Howard, although she also traveled as a foreign correspondent. Her work has been profiled in PS, Political Science and Politics, as well as in Bob Vitalis' book, and that she is the subject of at least one intellectual biography in progress, so we know who that is. So I want to conclude by talking a little bit about where she stands on IR theory, because one of the arguments of Errol Henderson, who was part of the Millennium Special issue on race in international relations a couple of years ago, he wrote about a couple of other folks in the Howard School, and he takes Vitalis to issue to task for basically understating, in his view, the contributions of some of the Howard School to IR theory, not simply to empirical studies of IR, especially in notions of community and culture. But I think that one question that I have that I kept going over is, to what degree do we expect a Mersey Tate to be at the vanguard of bringing in imperialism, race, etc., simply because she was African American? And is that fair? Should we make that the litmus test of her scholarship in IR theory and diplomatic history? On the other hand, she had her own voice on diplomatic history and IR theory, I would argue, whether or not one brings in imperialism and race, but she did then move toward a stronger critique of imperialism and of race. And then, if we recall, she was a student of Zimmern's. Jeannie Moorfield's conclusion about Murray, Gilbert Murray, and Alfred Zimmern is, their attempts to fuse liberalism with an enriched sense of global community ultimately naturalized a theory of world order that not only assumed massive inequality on a global scale, but also camouflaged the power politics of empire. So Jeannie is a strong critic of theirs, and one can only imagine that you are working under the direction of particular people, and then you're getting published in areas at very good presses. And to what degree did that constrain things, versus to what degree is this what she wanted to say? She clearly had an understanding of status quo issues in the midst of sovereignty. That was very important. She understood the excuses made by powers who did not want to disarm, and she pinpointed the technical versus the political. She did the same with peace forces who wanted to ignore problems of changing the status quo. And her discussion, I think, of both an international peace force and international atomic control was very interesting and not utopian, but it doesn't also fall easily in realpolitik. Now, her work on race, while not dispositive to her early work, one of the fascinating things she does say at the end of this book is she takes both the U.S. and Britain to task for their immigration policies. And she said, if the U.S. had not had its policy of exclusion of Japanese back in the 1920s and 30s, and if the U.K., if the Commonwealth, did not have its Caucasian-only immigration policies, then she thinks the naval conferences would have gone much, much better, and we would have had a much better appeal for peace. But this is just kind of snuck in at the very end, and I find that quite interesting as well. So on that, I will stop, and I look forward to your comments and questions.
Thank you.